Specifically, our goal in this panel is to dig into the two existing proposals that are currently in the General Assembly, Senate Bill 3 and House Bill 1, and what I think worked really nicely in the first panel, so a great idea, thanks, Senator, is to just sort of go down the line, have everybody introduce themselves. We've already heard from the chief, but she can introduce herself as well. But now, turning from the general discussion of criminal justice reform and the range of issues that implicates to the very specific question of, I think I'm eager to actually have the conversation be, what do you think was the most problematic aspect of issue one? I know Lou Tobin mentioned, you know, Ohio voters rejected it by a 2-to-1 margin, and a number of people have debated in a number of ways why that is. A number of the folks on this panel were vocal about concerns they had about issue one. And so going down the line, introducing yourselves, saying kind of what concerned you most, perhaps, or what you thought was most important to bring forward from that state issue that the voters turned away, and then turning that into what you think is most important that a General Assembly bill include. So, you know, kind of that one piece, and it can be, obviously, if you've been involved and sponsored the Senate Bill 3 or House Bill 1, talking about what you think is most important in that bill, and then we can get into sort of more of the details of that legislation and thoughts about its current state and its prospective future. But I don't want to lose sight of, it's in some sense why we're here a year later, what was there in issue one and what each of the panelists think was either the biggest vice or the biggest virtue in the proposal that was brought to voters. And so I'll start again with the Chief Justice, and she's right here, and we'll go down the line. People may remember advocacy around it a year ago, but I think it's useful to sort of provide that refresher as we then transition to a conversation about Senate Bill 3 and House Bill 1, which clearly kind of emerge from the work of issue 1. So with that, Chief.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me on this panel
as well. I think that one of the things is that addiction is a health issue. It has a criminal justice feature to it, but it's also a health issue first and foremost. And that was one of the, I think, shortcomings of issue one, was the fact that it was not, there were a lot of shortcomings to it. Number one, it was a constitutional amendment, which I think was not the way to have something as that needed to be as fluid as treatment options and legislation, you know, put into the Constitution. That was number one. I think that there was a reluctance to have folks that were dealing and using fentanyl and carfentanyl, deadly substances like that, receive the type of treatment that issue one would have provided for. So I think that tells us something. I think it tells us if we look at the statistics, both national and here in the state, that people want treatment for those that are addicted. Why is that? Because one in three people, maybe it might even be more now, have experienced a loved one, a neighbor, you know, a friend, the child of a friend, whomever, that has been involved in with drugs and been involved in and been addicted. So it is a health issue that people can sympathize with, yet they want treatment and they want effective treatment. Is accountability and sustainability and a recognition of what the disease actually is. And that's why I think the provisions of HB1 make more sense than certainly what is happening with SB3.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dr. Mark Hurst, and I'm the medical director for the Ohio Department of Health. I'm a psychiatrist and addiction psychiatrist, and I've been with the Department of Health now for all of 5 months. Prior to that, I was with the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services as medical director for a number of years and then for a period as director. And during that time, I had the honor to be able to supervise the recovery services in the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. So this has been part of my career for some time. I'm probably the last person you want to hear anything about the legal aspects because I'm not a lawyer and I don't know anything about that. So we can make a deal here. You don't practice medicine and I won't practice law, if that's okay with you. So I agree entirely with Chief Justice O'Connor, and I think most of us agree that diseases need to be treated, and that the criminal justice system is not always the best place for people to receive that treatment. On the other hand, as an addiction treatment provider, I think all of us recognize nobody gets into treatment because their using career is going so particularly well. People get into treatment because there's been some kind of consequence that has occurred. Of all of the people who have an addictive disorder, only about 1 in 10 are interested in getting treatment at any given time. And that's because of the denial of the disease. This is the only disease I can think of that, as it continues to progress, it keeps telling you that you're doing okay and the problems are outside of you. They aren't inside of you and not something that you need to deal with. The world really needs to change in order to accommodate to how you're living. But when those events occur, be it a broken marriage, be it a lost job, be it an arrest, that gets people's attention. In the treatment field, we call those things change motivators. And the whole science of change is something that is really important. And capitalizing on those change motivators in order to get people into treatment, to maintain them in treatment for a significant period of time, because this is a chronic disease and requires treatment for a significant period of time, is something that's critical. And the partnership between the treatment field, the courts, the jails and the prisons is really important for us to have good long-term effects in those who enter into that system. I think the only thing I could say about the previous issue one, and here it is, I said I'm not a lawyer and I'm not going to practice law. So I'm not going to practice law, but I'm going to just make a comment. You know, my understanding is that the Constitution, although not a static document, is a document that's very difficult to change. And our knowledge of the addiction treatment field is expanding and changing every year. We know much more about the treatment of addiction now than we did even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So being able to adapt in real time in order to be able to respond to those changes in the field, I think is something that's going to be critical as we look at moving forward with this. Thank you.
My name's John Eklund. I'm state senator for the 18th Senate District, which is up in Lake County, Geauga County, and all of Portage County. Thank you all for allowing me to be with you today. What an interesting room. I've never been here before. I was an opponent of issue one for many of the same reasons that have been articulated, particularly the doctor's comment about the difficulty in changing the Constitution in a field in which knowledge and advances are being made on a hopefully rapid and ever increasingly rapid pace. And I share the chief's concern about the fact that it did not contain any mechanism for addressing the sickness side of the issue. And third, I would say that I was very concerned about the retroactivity provisions that were contained in issue one, in as much as they were not linked in any respect to any demonstrated participation in treatment or effective participation in treatment. So those were the primary issues I had with issue one, I suppose. Now, it's unclear to me whether you want to get into Senate Bill 3 or not.
We'll get into that next, but you're more than welcome to get us started.
I think we'll just keep it moving along. The agenda I saw said 1 to 2 minutes of introduction.
That's good.
That's my
good.
1 to 2 minutes. Thank you again for having me.
Leave it to the senator to stay on time in a way that few of the rest of us can.
Oh, so. And by the way, doctor, you know, your admonition about not practicing medicine is a good one, but one that's, as you've shown with your promise not to practice law, is a very difficult one to keep.
I agree.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Hi, I'm Gary Daniels. I'm the lobbyist for the ACLU of Ohio. I've been with the organization for 21 years, having started back in 1995, left for a few years, and came back. So I've been around to see the trends in Ohio with regard to this issue. I've been full-time lobbying at the legislature for 12 years, well before House Bill 86. So I think I have a good global perspective of what's been going on in Ohio in the legislature. The ACLU of Ohio gladly supported issue one, and I think certainly the reason we did it was the reason that so many other people, 1 million plus people, voters in Ohio, supported it, is because we're tired of waiting. Because nothing, at least since I started in 1995 with the ACLU of Ohio, nothing's fundamentally changed. When you look at the raw numbers, when I started, our prisons were overcrowded, and it's only gotten worse since. There was a lot of talk about House Bill 86 on the previous panel. Well, if you crunch the numbers, we actually have 150 more people in prison right now today for drug possession offenses than we did when House Bill 86 was passed into law. So House Bill 86, I will concede that it has kept it from getting even worse, but it hasn't really fundamentally improved anything. And I certainly get the argument and the resistance of people talking about this. It shouldn't be done as a constitutional amendment. But for the ACLU of Ohio and the ACLU nationally, having worked at these issues and really committed ourselves to an organization with this, one of the big reasons we do this is a racial justice impact. It is fundamentally unfair in our justice system that somebody who doesn't look like me, who is a different color, is more likely to be stopped, more likely to be searched, more likely to be arrested, more likely to be convicted, more likely to do more time, and more likely to be put to death for their crimes than me. And you know, at the ACLU of Ohio, we just can't go to Cleveland and Akron and Youngstown and Cincinnati and all these places and say, you know what, just wait. The legislature is going to take care of this problem. That hasn't happened, even with some of the reform efforts, which have been very positive over the years, but they just haven't done enough, and they just haven't done it quick enough. And we are the same essential place we were when I started again back in 1995. That's a long time, and we are still waiting for that change.
Thank you, Representative Plummer.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, everybody. It's an honor to be here with you guys, and thanks for your interest in this. We have to get this right. I'll give you guys a background on me. I was in law enforcement for 30 years in Montgomery County, Dayton, Ohio, one of the worst hit cities in the nation with the opioid epidemic. 30-year career, fantastic career, really loved it, but I got tired of running in quicksand. You know, we were running, but we weren't going anywhere. So I said, I'm going to go to the State House and try to change some policies and try to get this fixed along with our mental health problem fixed. So, you know, I opposed issue one because there was no hammer there. My experience, when an addict will go to treatment for one of two reasons. He's tired of being tired. Wake up and said, man, I'm tired of chasing the dragon, or the criminal justice system forces them into treatment. We've had more luck forcing them into treatment. When the addict gets locked up, put in jail, a lot of times they hit rock bottom and they say, man, I gotta do something about this before I lose everything. So we came up with House Bill 1, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But the intent of that is, we all know this is a disease. You know, it's changing people's brains for like 6 months. And even our treatment is failing because we're treating people for 30 days. And our addicts are sitting in treatment centers for 30 days waiting on day 31 to go get high again. And we're wasting millions of dollars with that program. So we got a lot of work to do, you guys, but you know, with groups like us, we can solve this. And you know, I'm not the person that knows everything, but I do have some pretty good life experiences dealing with this. So my door is open for any suggestions, any solutions, but let's get this right. Let's get people cleaned up, get them back on their feet, and get them back to live the American dream like we are living. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator, you'll wrap it up, and then we'll turn to the specifics of SB 3 and HB 1.
Sure. And I'm going to go ahead and take some of that extra time John Eklund should have used. I will try to confine myself to 1 to 2 minutes, but that will be challenging. First, issue one was flawed for a whole host of reasons. You've heard a lot of them already. But for me, some of the major ones were you shouldn't be doing things that ought to be statutory by constitutional amendment, and I feel that way about every issue. But certainly things like drug policy, I don't think have any business being in the Constitution. I think the Constitution should be about 6 pages long. It ought to say, here are the branches of government, here are the rights of the people, and that's about it. Not substantive criminal law. Second, I don't think that it adequately distinguished between people who have simple possession for their own use because they're addicts from people who are carrying large quantities of hard drugs at distribution levels. And in addition to not really distinguishing between those, and I think there were some examples that the Chief Justice used around the state last year, I mean, massive numbers that could cause, you know, in some cases, I think potentially thousands of overdoses or certainly, you know, significant problems like that. But it also didn't allow for the right penalties for people who were carrying large quantities like that. So if you were caught for possession under the issue one language, I think you could not even be sentenced to jail time for at least your first two offenses within a certain period of time. And it seems to me that if you're carrying distribution quantity levels of fentanyl or heroin or OxyContin or any of these things, the judge should at least have the option of sending you to prison. So a lot of things packed in there, but I think it's also important to recognize that the efforts in the legislature to reform how we do drug sentencing have far predated issue one. And while for some members of the legislature, issue one may have been a catalyst, the fact is we were working on the Criminal Justice Recodification Commission for a number of years before that, that it had already issued its set of findings and recommendations, which was, I believe, the longest non-budget bill ever drafted by the Legislative Service Commission, and that some parts of that, in fact, had become law even prior to last year's election, including some portions of what became Senate Bill 66, which John Eklund was one of the sponsors of, that I believe became effective last October. So, but certainly, if you go back as long as I've been in the legislature, this has been one of our primary issues. And I just there's always more work to be done, and the problem has in many ways outpaced our ability to keep up. But to suggest that there hasn't been a lot done on this or that the legislature hasn't been working on this, and I've heard that suggestion in some cases. Gary didn't say that, but you said something that almost came close, I think. And I think in defense of the legislature, I'd take a look at House Bill 86 from the 129th General Assembly, which was a substantial rewrite of Ohio sentencing laws. It made literally dozens of changes. It shortened the prison terms for certain drug-related offenses. It permitted intervention in lieu of conviction for offenders with mental illness, intellectual disabilities, or drug or alcohol use. It established risk reduction sentencing, so that offenders could get supervised release by completing treatment after serving 80% of their prison time. It imposed a presumption against jail time for fourth and fifth degree felonies that were not violent offenses. We had House Bill 56 and the 131st GA, which was commonly referred to as the Ohio Fair Hiring Act or the Ban the Box Bill. In House Bill 49, one of our budget bills in the 132nd General Assembly, we made significant changes, including permitting offenders to serve terms for less than 12 months in a county jail instead of a state prison so that they could remain near their families, including expanding opportunities for individuals seeking community-based substance abuse treatment, including capping the amount of time that offenders could be sent back to prison for technical parole violations. In the capital budget in the 132nd General Assembly, we invested hundreds of millions of dollars, including a big portion of the community projects allocation, into drug treatment and rehabilitation. The Plain Dealer at the time and Laura Bischoff at the Dayton Daily News said that we spent $222 million to fight the opioid crisis and to treat those with mental illnesses. And again, Senate Bill 66, which became effective last fall, right around this time, said that one of the primary purposes of felony sentencing was to provide offenders with a renewed opportunity to find gainful employment. It expanded eligibility for intervention in lieu of conviction for individuals who committed criminal acts while they were addicted to drugs or alcohol. It granted judges discretion to keep offenders who relapse in addiction treatment rather than sending them to prison. It expanded the eligibility for pretrial diversion to include persons charged with certain minor drug offenses, and it reduced from 9 months to 90 days the maximum amount of time an offender could be sent to prison for a post-release control sanction. So I would say this is something we've tried to tackle from all fronts, and sentencing reform has been a big part of that, and it's probably been the largest front that we fought this battle on. I view Senate Bill 3 and House Bill 1 as the next step in that fight. But that's not the fight by itself. It's not this one issue in response to issue one. It is part of a 10-year process to make our criminal justice system make more sense.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for providing that background. And that's a nice table setting for talking specifically about Senate Bill 3 and House Bill 1. And Senator Eklund, I want to reward you for keeping it brief before to give you the first chance to, you know, as you of the most important provisions of that and what the Senate looks to achieve through that proposal. And then maybe we'll hear from the representative about the House Bill 1. But all of you should feel comfortable, since you're in the midst of the legislative debate, speaking about any provisions of that. And then we'll hear from the other folks about their opinions on how you all are doing.
Great. Thank you. There really are three main issues that Senate Bill 3 seeks to address. One, redemption. It's the action of saving or being saved from sin, error, or evil. Redemption. Number two, stigma. The stigma of a felony criminal charge or a felony criminal conviction when your biggest mistake was succumbing to the allure of drugs. Stigma. And third is public safety. How can we make people safer from themselves and safer from the actions of others? Those are, in my mind, the three main issues. We attempt in the bill, and there's been a substitute bill that's been drafted, and it's not quite ready for full discussion because we're taking amendments as well. And the LSC is in the process of doing the summary of the substitute bill, but the committee has taken it. We address those three issues in turn. In terms of redemption, the bill would propose to make relatively low-level possession offenses unclassified misdemeanors rather than the felonies that they often are today. And they are eligible for an abeyance procedure that the bill sets out, through which the charge is not even actually filed, but rather the court, if they decide that it's appropriate to do it, holds the case in abeyance and orders the alleged offender into a treatment program designed by the court with help from professionals and to which the defendant agrees to comply. And that process then goes on. That's largely avoiding or dealing with the redemption issue. Give somebody a chance without having to basically confess a crime in order to do it. If in fact the treatment is successfully completed under the substitute bill, then the case is dismissed. There is no record. There's nothing to purge, there's nothing to seal, there's nothing to anything. It's done. We deal with the stigma issue largely through this unclassified misdemeanor designation of the offenses, the possession offenses. Again, under the bill, if someone is convicted of ultimately the offense, they face up to 364 days in jail. And that is to say, these unclassified misdemeanors do not carry with them zero sanctions or zero consequences if somebody messes up in their treatment and ultimately the case is renewed, tried, and the person is convicted. So the stigma is removed by not even calling these things felonies in the first place, but rather calling them unclassified misdemeanors. And on the public safety side, we changed the way we're dealing with the trafficking offenses such that if a certain amount of the drugs are found in the possession of somebody, there would be a presumption that that person is trafficking in drugs. The prosecution would not have to prove that the drugs were sold, offered, prepared for sale, prepared for transportation, or any of the other things that currently they have to prove trafficking. And you wouldn't have to prove that the person who has the drugs knows or has reason to believe that they're going to be sold or resold. If you just have that many drugs in your possession, the bill calls for a presumption that that person is trafficking. Now, I think it's also important to remember on the possession amounts that we're calling unclassified misdemeanors in the bill, if the prosecution can prove that the person had those drugs with the purpose or with reason to believe that they were going to be resold, that possession charge could be charged as a felony. So you'll hear a lot of people talk about how, well, you know, there's no real teeth in this because they're unclassified misdemeanors. If there was evidence that the prosecutors had and the investigators had to suggest that even these smaller amounts were intended to be dished out to other people, then they can charge as a felony and you get whatever the felony consequences are as they are today. They would be classified in what we were calling trafficking as opposed to major trafficking or aggravated trafficking. So that's another important feature that I think it's important to keep in mind when everybody hears misdemeanor and they say, oh, geez, nobody will go to treatment to avoid time in jail. Nobody will go to treatment when they're only charged with a misdemeanor. I think a lot of these folks would be charged with felony trafficking if, again, the prosecutors have the evidence to suggest that the elements of that crime are committed. So three points, three generalized ways in which we're proposing to deal with them in the bill. In my mind, and I don't mean to minimize them for any of you in the audience, everything else associated with the bill, and there are a lot of things, is largely mechanics. Where should the charge be brought? How do we manage this new process without doing damage to the good work that the drug courts are doing? Should we or should we not make the new designations retroactive? The civil commitment process we address in the bill as well, trying to make that a little bit more streamlined so that families and friends who want to help their loved ones get treatment and they otherwise won't go, involuntary civil commitment to do. And there's always the question, as there is in so many of these areas,
penalty enhancements. Great topic around the legislature. But we'll deal in one way or the other in the bill with the question of whether or not a possession charge or a trafficking charge carries with it an enhanced penalty if, for example, it's undertaken within proximity to a school or within proximity to a drug treatment center or within proximity to juveniles. That is a very, very dicey issue, but it's mechanics to me. I've tried to lay out the fundamentals and the...
And you did a terrific job, and I'm grateful for that. I'm wondering if Representative Plummer is comfortable doing the same with respect to HB 1 or drawing a contrast between what the House is considering and what the Senate's considering.
Okay, I'll try a little shorter than that one, but good job, Senator. We'll talk later. House Bill 1, the intent of House Bill 1, there's still a consequence, so we're still sticking with the felony. But we're going to get you into treatment, and we're going to give you treatment in lieu of conviction. You know, we do that now, but here's the problem we're seeing with addicts. You know, it takes about 6 months to get your case through court. And that's, you know, we'll arrest you. We'll hold you in jail for 3 days. We'll have to send the substance over to the crime lab to be tested to start the whole process. And that's usually about a six-month process. In between that six-month window, the addict didn't say, oh, my God, they caught me. I'm going to quit using. They're going out to get high again. So they're picking up 3, 4, 5 felonies before the first one even gets through the court system. So ours is really looking at expunging records, sealing records, you know, getting people back on their feet. I have some very close friends that went through the process. You know, we caught them one time. We got that expunged. We got treatment in lieu of conviction. But like I said, they picked up case 2, 3, 4, and 5 along the way. So what we did on the first case didn't matter. You know, we took a step forward and 3 steps backwards. So House Bill 1 still has the accountability part. I'm interested in changing it to a misdemeanor and giving 354 days, but the problem I'm seeing there is, being a former sheriff, is our jails are full too. You know, the prisons are full, jails are full. In my time at the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, we've been sued 3 times federally on jail overcrowding. So we don't have the resources to handle this either locally, and we have to keep that in mind. We got to quit pushing these problems down to local folks without solutions. So I'm very concerned about jail overcrowding. I just got out of another federal lawsuit on jail overcrowding. So I think our bill will help more folks out in the long run, because once we get them in the treatment, we get their brain clean, you know, they want to get back on with life, but they still have 2, 3, and 4 felonies chasing them down the street. We've done nothing for these folks.
So, Gary, you said earlier you're tired of waiting, or maybe you were thinking about the people of the state of Ohio being tired of waiting. Are either of these bills what you've been waiting for?
I will say that the ACLU of Ohio, we are cheerleaders for both SB3 and HB1. Are the bills perfect? No, they're not perfect. If you're going to sit around and wait for a perfect bill on anything, you're going to be waiting forever.
But the bulk of these bills is great, and we have before and continue to compliment the Chief Justice, Senator Eklund, Representative Plummer, and Senate President Obhoff, because the easy thing to do after issue one would have been to say, hey, look, the people of Ohio have spoken. We don't need to address this. But instead, they said, look, they're making points here, and we agree with some of these fundamental points, and let's take a look at this. So we support, again, we're head cheerleaders for these bills. Again, think they could be better, in particular with SB3. You know, one of the big pushes that we have is we would like to see it fully retroactive. If it's the right thing to do going forward for people in Ohio, then we cannot leave people behind and say, you're still going to be saddled with that felony record. You're still going to be in prison or jail as a result of your felony drug offense. Now, I also understand in this legislature that's not the most popular idea, so we have to deal with political realities, but it's not going to stop the ACLU of Ohio for pushing for this, whether in SB3 or in addition to any number of other bills that we can do this. And I think it's also very important when we're talking about both SB3 and HB1 and the effects, the positive effects it's going to have on Ohio. Senate President Obhoff listed a variety of reform bills that have passed and been enacted over the years. But at the same time, the very frustrating aspect of being a part of this debate and working on this issue on a daily basis is the General Assembly also continually passes bills to put people in prison and jail. We have a report that we've done for the past two legislative sessions called the State House to Prison Pipeline that goes through every single bill introduced and shows you where this would have led to more people being incarcerated, whether it's introduced, whether it's passed. We track both of them. And I want to mention three bills in particular that are going to very much limit the overall effectiveness of SB3 and HB1 that were passed or are due to pass here real soon. You've got SB1, the fentanyl sentencing bill that was passed and enacted just before issue one. That is designed to put more people in prison. And it was sold as targeting traffickers and not users, but look at the bill itself. It dramatically increases penalties for possession of fentanyl as well. Senate Bill 201, the Reagan-Tokes bill that was passed not that long ago, bringing back indefinite sentencing for a variety of offenses in Ohio, is designed to put more people into prison. And now you have House Bill 55 to up drug trafficking penalties for people that passed the Senate overwhelmingly, is slated to pass the House here, I think, soon, overwhelmingly. This is a bipartisan problem here in Ohio. Unfortunately, I think any of these bills taken by itself might eventually push Ohio to a record prison population. All three of these bills together, I think, unquestionably will. Anybody wants to make a friendly wager after the event, I'm happy to do it and happy to be proven wrong. But again, we're passing major bills to put a lot more people in prison, including for drug offenses, at the same time that we're undergoing reform efforts, and we can't keep doing this.
So, Dr. Hurst, I promise not to ask you to practice law, and so I'll turn the conversation to your perspective as a doctor. Regardless of the provisions of
HB1 and SB3, what would you say, speaking to the legislature, speaking to the people in this room, is the most important thing for any legislative reform to do to help with the addiction problem, to help with the range of issues that it necessarily implicates, looking at it as a medical issue rather than as a legal issue?
And I appreciate that question, because at a core, this is a medical issue. And I certainly took to Senator Eklund's comments about redemption. Because, you know, the individuals who are affected with substance use disorders didn't choose to do this. It wasn't at age 11 or 12 somebody said, given my life circumstance, I think that I'll grow up to have a substance use disorder. You know, we know that as a result of their biological predisposition or what they brought into this world genetically and what they experienced in this world, that the brains of individuals who have addictive disorders respond to substances in ways that those of us who don't have addiction don't. And we can't always appreciate what happens. And then there are all the consequences that flow from that. And as I mentioned earlier, sometimes those consequences are what lead to treatment. They at least lead to the initiation of treatment. And I think we would be in agreement that incarceration alone is not treatment. Incarceration alone may shock someone and make someone change behavior for the short term, but the long term requires counseling, it requires medication frequently, and it requires rebuilding the life. So when the senator mentioned how we would have less felony convictions, we would have more people who would be on a misdemeanor kind of level, I think that's really important because employment is a really important part of recovery and rebuilding somebody's life. And a felony conviction is a major barrier to that. So, you know, I think all of those are good things and in the right direction. The chief and I were talking just real briefly on the side here about treatment capacity. If we do this, are we going to have the treatment capacity? And it's a valid concern. We certainly have much more treatment capacity than we had 7 or 8 years ago. Medicaid expansion was important with that, but we're still not there. We're not to the point yet of having treatment on demand. And really for us to intervene with those change motivators, we need to get to the point of where we have that treatment on demand. And it has to do with more than building facilities, it has to do with us developing our workforce further also.
Very good, thank you, Doctor. Well, I'm gonna have the Chief Justice practice law because that's what she does for the state. And I'll finish with Senator Obhoff kind of putting him on the spot to make a prediction about where we might be in the legislative process and what we could hope to expect with any of the bills moving forward to get to the governor's desk, and then we'll have a few minutes, I hope, for questions from the audience. So get your questions ready, and Chief,
Whether it's a particular provision in these bills, whether it's your own view looking over the work of the judiciary and your role in the state that's unique, your own perspective on what's critical for the legislature to move forward on these topics so that we continue to move forward on these issues.
Thanks for the opportunity again to speak here. I think that both SB 1, HB, or SB 3 and HB 1 are attempting to treat the problem, but, you know, the way I look at it is, why do we have the problem? And for the record, I'm fully backing HB 1 for a variety of reasons, but I'm going to use my time to advocate for another perspective here. I look at it, the three E's. We have education, employment, and environment. And any one of those being weak, all three being weak, and you can predict that someone is going to be involved in the criminal justice system. Somebody is going to attempt to chemically cope with their lives, which is another way of saying using drugs and becoming addicted. So we as a society, we as government, we as a legislature, the executive branch, and the judiciary, have to look at how do we improve our education so that all people share in our educational opportunities to enhance inner city schools, the opportunities that people have for education, because I think we all agree that education is the ticket to employment. And having the initiative for full employment in this state, meaningful employment, not just menial service jobs that are not paying enough to support a family, I think that that's extremely important. The environment, where children grow up, where young adults are in their lives, what their environment is going to predict how successful they're going to be in their lives and how they're going to gravitate towards a life of crime or addiction or other destructive behavior. You know, as I said, the allure of escapism is what drives a lot of people, both adults and youngsters, into the type of addiction problems that we're talking about. So, that's a whole set, and that's a really complicated, set of problems, and I don't have solutions for that, but you know, that's a challenge for the legislature and the executive branch to look at immediately. I think the question of the stigma of a felony seems to be, in my mind, it's very real to have a felony on your conviction. And that's one of the beauties of HB1, is that if someone is arrested and they are in the common pleas court, the first avenue that a judge must employ with that defendant is an intervention in lieu of conviction. And it would be an expansion of eligibility for that program and an opportunity for more people to participate in that. And the beauty of an intervention in lieu or a treatment in lieu, however you want to phrase it, is that you have the treatment, you have the incentive that a court offers, the accountability, but at the end of the program, you don't have a conviction. Now, what do you do with the low-level felons that already have felony convictions? And that's where HB1 allows for the sealing of records, expanding the ability for the sealing of records, what type of offenses, the number of offenses that you can have that have accumulated. And so that removes the stigma of a felony from the record for employment purposes, housing purposes, and education purposes. You can live with a felony, and you can live with a sealed felony, and you can go through that process. What you can't live with is a lifelong addiction left untreated. So, you know, it's not an either or. HB1 addresses the need for wiping your slate clean, so to speak, but it also has that incentive and that accountability that forces people into treatment. And I think if you talk to anybody in the treatment community, they will tell you that the lever that will get people to stay in treatment and save their lives are the court systems, the criminal justice system.
Thank you, Chief. Senator Aboff, I'm more than happy if you want to talk about SB3 or HB1 in its particulars, but I'll sort of set up my question as both a compliment but one with a little bit of bite, which is I think there may have been a lot of citizens voting on issue one who heard many folks in this room, many others say, we're supportive of reform, but issue one's the wrong way to do it. It shouldn't be a constitutional amendment. It shouldn't have certain provisions in it. And the compliment is, I think all of the leaders in the state have lived up to their commitment to focus on this issue and try to move forward legislatively, even after SB1 lost. And it would have been, I think, quite easy to look at that result and say, well, the voters don't want anything like this. We shouldn't stay focused on this issue. So absolutely wonderful, and a compliment to so many of the people in this room and elsewhere who have worked, I think, quite hard to move us to this point a year later. But it's a year later, and there's been no change, and there are two bills, and those two bills are subject to terrific debates like we've had here. But when will bills get to the governor's desk? What can we expect for that voter who is already thinking now about whether there's been talk and effort to move forward with reform, but we haven't seen it yet?
I don't think there's any question that in this general assembly, perhaps both of these bills get to the governor's desk. I think that, frankly, SB3 could pass the Senate anytime we want it to. But we have taken the time to work with our friends in the judiciary, our friends in the Prosecutors Association, and a number of other people to try to figure out where the right landing place is policy-wise, whether that's what's in House Bill 1, what's currently in Senate Bill 3, or somewhere in between. And I don't think there's any question that we could pass House Bill 1 basically at any time as well. I think the real task before the Judiciary Committee right now is what is the right policy? But I think it's important to note that everybody on this stage right now, and most of the people I think who are here in the room today, Medina to unveil a documentary about a number of courts and the good work that they're doing right now helping people turn their lives around. And while the Prosecuting Attorneys Association and a number of their members have expressed concern about some of the current levels of drug possession that are in the current draft of the bill, they've been very productive working with us to say, okay, well, here are different numbers that might be okay. Not okay, but that might work in terms of coming up with a better outcome for what the statute should look like. The fact that there's basically 90 to 95% agreement, I think, is a significant win already, because if you go back 15 or 20 years and we tried to have this discussion, there's a chance that every single person on the stage, or all of them but one or two, would say, forget this, I'm going to be tough on crime, I'm going home, I'm going to ratchet up penalties as much as I can, and that's that. Because that's an easy thing to say, it's an easy thing to do, it's something that I think a lot of people have a positive reaction to instinctively, and I think instead we've seen a sea change over the last decade among policymakers in Ohio, and to some degree nationally, that we need to put more thought into these things. And it's not just about being tough on crime, it's about being smart on crime, it's about making sure that your solutions to these problems actually work. And that's what you've seen in the legislature over the last 10 years. It's what you've seen in the work done by the Chief Justice and a number of other people, like what you can see in that documentary that I referenced earlier. And frankly, you're seeing that at the national level. When President Trump signed the First Step Act, I think that was a big deal nationally, because it perhaps sent a signal to people, first of all, that people in both parties can work together on substantive policy, even though you get the impression watching D.C. that's not possible on some major issues like this one. It actually is. But also a signal to people who would traditionally, I'd say, be more conservative lawmakers or tough on crime, if you want to call it that, that actually being smart on crime is the right policy, that there's nothing conservative about locking up more people than you ought to, but putting people in prison who don't belong there, and that it's time to rethink all these issues. And I think that by and large, in both parties, in both chambers, you have people who understand that. And now it's a matter of how do we work out the last 5% that we disagree on.
Of this terrific panel, and
Well, I don't know who would be accessing a sealed record that if the record is sealed and it's not disclosed on an application, et cetera, I'm not sure. And your record is sealed?
Correct.
Okay, then. Well, that record's not sealed. Okay, then it's not sealed if they're looking at it, because that's not the way it's supposed to work. Well, that needs to be, the system needs to be addressed. If there are jurisdictions that are not sealing those records the way they're supposed to be sealed, well, then that's a problem. And that can be addressed. But as far as, when I said living with a felony, I mean you can live with your felony until, if it's eligible for sealing, it gets sealed. But treatment for an addiction is a lifelong path, a lifelong journey. You don't get cured from addiction. You have to battle with it. And if you speak to anybody who has done that battle and has been successful, even for 10, 20 years, they're still doing the battle. And that's why this treatment feature is so important, and building our capacity within this state is so important. And having programs and having responses like treatment in lieu of conviction is essential. So there is no felony to seal with something like that.
Senator Eklund, I thought you may want to speak to that.
If I may, and of course the justice, the chief is correct in many respects, but we can't lose sight of the fact. On Mr. Polk here, I don't have to go find a criminal record, right? I go to something they call Google. And I Google their name, and if there's been a newspaper report somewhere along the line about the time that Jahaga Fackel was arrested for trafficking drugs or possession of drugs and was charged with a felony, and I'm an employer, I probably am not going to go any farther than that. And we can't seal the Google records, right? That's part of the problem. The other part of the problem, which we've heard in testimony and over time, has been that there are actually entrepreneurial business people out there who think the trafficking in information is a pretty good business. And so they find a way to sweep the records of the criminal courts over the course of time, store that information, and they serve as a background checker. And if I'm an employer, I go to them, check the background on Eklund, and there's a record of Eklund having been arrested for drug possession 6 years ago. That, for many employers and housing people and everybody else, is enough. You know, I don't care whether he was convicted. I don't care whether he was found not guilty. Charged with a felony drug possession, he gets an F. And so those are added issues that go beyond the sealing of records. I think the chief is right. I don't hear a lot about failures of the sealing process as it's in place, but what I hear about is there's more than one way to skin a cat when you're looking for that information.
I think we have time for one more, and well, we have an issue one drafter. Go ahead, Stephen.
Just one other layer to the record sealing problem of stigma of felon records is that by law, there are 570 job areas triggered by felon drug possession that explicitly say you can see that record even if it has been sealed. That's in the state law for licensure, for entrepreneurial opportunities, as well as working in. So the record sealing is it's a leaky seal by design in the actual text of the law. So I wonder why we can't both decrease the likelihood of something different while increasing the access to treatment.
I for one, applaud that notion. I mean, I have thought from the beginning that the two bills are perfectly capable of functioning in a dovetailing sort of fashion, addressing the issues from two slightly different angles.
I think one of the other solutions would be to take a look at those 500-some provisions and have the legislature revamp that legislation and see what truly needs to be known for a particular licensing or occupation or whatever those exposures subject themselves to. And that's purely a legislative fix, which I don't think will be that hard.
And I'll just say, if I could get a 30 seconds here, Doug. Expanding record sealing is great. Expanding expungement is great. Expanding intervention in lieu of conviction is great. Expanding drug courts, that's all great. But we are not going to record seal, expunge, ILC, or drug court our way out of all of these problems. We have a very real crisis here in Ohio, not just with the people in prison. There's people who get felony records who, of course, don't go to prison. Our prisons release 20,000 people plus per year who have felony records, and so we have to get to the root causes of addiction and drug use. So, you know, when the ACLU of Ohio talks about reform efforts, again, all of that is very welcome, but we're talking R, reform with a big R, that is, to stop using incarceration as a way to, at this point, unsuccessfully deal with these fundamental drug and addiction issues.
You want to have the last word for us before we get to lunch?
Commentary. I want to urge you guys, we need to step up this process. 2 weeks ago, we seized enough carfentanil in Dayton to kill the entire population of the state of Ohio. 2 nights ago, I was driving home. I stopped to get gas. The pump next to me, 2 people were overdosed, so I had to go back to my old business, help get them attention. As I stand in there waiting on the medics and the police respond, the police were very slow because a Dayton officer just drug warrant where they seized 20 more kilos and $500,000 in cash. So this is very real. You know, our deaths are slowing down. Yes, we've turned the corner, but we're not out of the woods yet. We got to keep our foot on the gas and get this solved. You know, this is why I came here. Been working 11 months on this. We got to push the ball down the field. It ain't going to solve it all, but it's a start in the right direction, and there's still problems out there. And
important issue to all the policymakers on both sides of the aisle, but I again just want to reemphasize that it's a great sign that so many of us agree on the broad strokes, and now it's just a matter of working together to figure out, you know, how to best get there, and I do think that's a significant change from how things would have been 2 decades ago if we were having this conversation, and I am optimistic about at least one and probably both of these bills passing in the next, you know, few months.
Wonderful. Well, that's an optimistic sign. It's a great sign to have had all these terrific individuals share their time with us today and talk about this. I hope you'll join me in clapping for their participation.